haven't eaten yet. I'm like, I just had a taco, so wait.
Is that where you went to Scotch 80? Place is good.
Yeah, I don't know.
That is where you went. That's the steakhouse in Palms is Scotch 80.
Oh, no, we didn't do a steakhouse.
Oh,
no. Because tonight, I was just telling somebody, ever since you took me to T-Bones that one time, now we don't come here without
going
T-Bones
there.
Being on the list. So tonight, it's
that
T-Bones.
That is one of my favorite restaurants in the entire city.
Are we rolling?
Like, yep. Without a doubt, one of my favorite.
It's.
Where are you going tonight? T-Bones?
T-Bones.
What do you get there?
Steak, and lots of steak.
Get everything when you go there.
I always get so good. You know what's funny? I always get the grass-fed beef filet, and they serve it, they're like, well, you know that's going to be a little bit leaner. I'm like, yeah, that's why I order it. I said, I usually eat grass-fed elk, but you don't have that here. Yeah. So.
Don't sell it. No, it's that place is so good.
What's the preferable sides?
All of them.
Mashed potatoes, green beans.
I mean, I'm not a big mashed potatoes guy.
Just straight steak.
I mean, not
with a side of steak.
If I'm like
side of steak.
If I'm going, and if I'm going to Crush Food, like that's the mindset, and that's why I'm going there. Yeah, I get crab cocktail, shrimp cocktail. You got a bunch of other good appetizers.
Can't remember what cut it is, but they have this like 32-ounce steak there.
Yeah,
that's what I get when I go.
You get that to share on the table. So I usually
I eat that myself.
I usually get like an.
That's the definition of meat sweats.
I usually get like an 8-ounce filet Oscar style, and then I'll get that for the table, and then I'll get the salmon. They have a really good salmon, and I do like salmon a lot. So I'll eat the 8-ounce steak, share a little bit in the tomahawk cut up in the middle of the table, get the salmon as well, and then like all the sides. The cream corn is phenomenal side.
Brandon, when I first started working here, was the only one that was talking about T-Bones, and he's mentioned it several times over the years, but I've never been.
I have to take it.
I might have to go sometime.
Remember the Great Outdoors?
Yeah.
Right. The old 96er?
Yeah.
That's, I want to do that someday. I just love a big old steak. Just
that's what I was thinking about.
Oh, and then they got the pretzel bread. I just remember that, too. The pretzel bread with the maple butter.
Ooh, they do. And they come around with it warm on a tray.
Yeah.
And there's some other breads on there, but I
just go to pretzel every time. I don't even think about it.
Hey, no questions asked. Can you come back in about 10 minutes? Because this one's going to be gone.
No, so matter of fact, give me two. You're not going to come back fast enough.
Well, what I'm telling from this conversation is the person who's talking most about really good food is the person who did not get lunch.
Correct. As you can tell, I'm hungry.
Yeah.
But no, that's the other thing about T-Bones, though, is like if you want to go and like you're still on it and you don't want to kill yourself with food or at least try to kill yourself with food, just getting one steak, it's awesome. Yeah. Salmon's awesome.
Hmm. Get the French onion soup also.
Oh, that actually is good.
I love pretzel bread, French onion soup, tomahawk steak, salmon.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good.
What else?
So good, man. Crab cocktail.
Crab cocktail. Just keep on rolling. French onion soup, huh?
I end up in Vegas 5 or 6 times a year, and I'm no longer allowed to come here without a reservation at T-Bones. So
it's a great move.
Yeah.
It's a pro move, right?
And
there.
I blame it all on Lorenzo because he took me there the first time, and when I came back to the room, it was me and him and Porter. And my wife's like, how'd the meeting go? I'm like, oh, that went great, but man, we got to go to this restaurant.
Yeah.
So I took her back a couple nights later, and that's it.
Sorry for your wallet.
Yeah.
Other than that. Yeah. I mean, it is worth it, but it is one of them expensive steakhouses.
Yeah. Well, thanks for stopping in.
Oh, were we recording?
Yeah, we're recording. We're hot.
There you go.
I didn't know. Happy to be here.
Yeah, people probably recognize your voice. We got Randy Newberg in the house today. What brings you to Vegas? You down here for
Hunter and Outdoor Christmas?
Okay.
Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has that as part of the NFR and the Cowboy Christmas thing. And then I heard you guys were having a big open house last night, so I told my wife, you know what? We're heading down on Wednesday. Heck with going down on Thursday. So I showed up here. Man, that was a pretty big event last night.
Yeah, it was a packed house.
It was good crazy. Job. That was the first time ever, right?
First time we did anything that kind of that extent. Yeah,
technically, it's our second parking lot party, but the first one was just kind of slapped together and not a ton of thought, and we learned a lot from that one. Especially like when the best time to do it would be and why not now. So Paul, our total vibes guy. Paul's always locked into the vibes.
Paul.
And
Paul.
Out of, no. Man, he's the best.
This is a personal pet project for Paul, you can tell.
It was his plan to do it during Hunter Christmas.
Yeah.
So we did a roundup. It was awesome.
Cool. Yeah, mm-hmm. So I had to hurry up and go home. I got home from Arizona on Monday. Mm-hmm. Had enough time to throw all the hunting clothes out of my bag and replace them with...
work clothes.
Yeah, whatever. You know,
did you fly home or drive home from Arizona?
I flew home.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, by this time of year, I'm so tired of driving and travel and stuff.
I bet.
I'll fly, and I'll deal with a few inconveniences that I didn't bring with me that I normally bring in my truck. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
You flying with weapon and gear and everything?
Yeah, everything.
You got any tips for flying with a weapon?
Oh, we did a whole video on it.
Did you?
Yeah.
That's what we get asked a lot. It's interesting.
I always fly usually Alaska or Delta, and this time it was Southwest. I've done videos on this before, and some of the people who fly United and American say, well, that's not what they make me do. And usually the point of difference is ammo in your check bag or ammo in your gun case. With the airlines I fly, it's always the ammo goes in the gun case in a factory box, locked in there. And I've done that, and some people will email us and say, no way, not on, I can't remember, it's United or American. You cannot put that in your gun case. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
So.
It seems strange. You'd think they would all have the exact same rules.
You would imagine.
I will say, though.
But I'm not surprised.
I've had the same experience flying out of Vegas. It depends on, I'm trying to think who we flew with the one time, and it was different. They had different requests for what we did.
Yeah. So
Alaska's phenomenal.
Yeah, Alaska's
the best. Phenomenal. That's always my preferred if I'm going hunting, like with weapon check and gear check.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, obviously, flying Air Canada is only for one reason, going to Canada. They are phenomenal as well.
Yeah. I always find it so bizarre that it's easier to fly with a rifle or a hand, you know, sidearm. It's easier to fly like from Vegas to Alaska than it is from Alaska to the lower 48. Every time I fly from Alaska to the lower 48, it seems like it takes forever.
Really?
For them to check my weapon. Yeah, I've
almost told that story.
Yeah, it's awful. Drives me bonkers. I'm like,
is wild.
Which is weird because you would think it would be the opposite. You think being in Alaska that the other thing is,
I have this really nice Pelican airline gun case. Somehow TSA broke one of the latches on it.
Oh no!
Really? Yeah, and so the far end latch now flaps. It doesn't. You know how you really got to pop those things?
Yeah.
And they're like, you're going to tell me I couldn't use it. I'm like, well, you guys broke it.
Yeah.
How do you want me to get this thing home?
And it's not necessarily a cheap gun case.
Yeah.
Like these are multiple hundreds of dollar gun cases, and you guys broke it.
Yeah. Huh. And fortunately, there's a grommet right there where a lock goes in.
Mm-hmm.
So
just throw by the time over.
I have some pretty small locks so that they go on there tight and it cinched it down, but.
That is some bullshit, though. They broke it and then told you can't use it.
Yeah. So,
not surprised.
If anyone from Pelican is listening, I'm in the market for a new airline gun case.
Yeah. How was your year? Did you have a good year?
Way better than we deserve.
Yeah.
How some years you work your butt off and you're like, we deserve better than that. Or maybe some hunts.
Yeah, it just doesn't go your way.
Everywhere we went, it was almost as if the animals said, boy, I'd really like to be on video this year. The only hunts where my Montana elk tag, I could have filled it numerous times, but I'd seen a really nice bull, and so I passed and passed, and then season closed, and I'm standing around with my tag in my pocket still.
But you saw a lot of bulls, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
yeah. Every day I saw bulls, and opening day I saw some. A lot of them, but that's probably the only tag where we didn't end up gutting and gilling, as they say.
Yeah.
And you're already fast into planning for next year. We've been talking. We got here earlier this morning. Randy and I sat here at the exact same spots, into the tables, and talked.
Not surprised.
Yeah. Talked applications and strategy shop. And talk shop. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm already, you know, elbow deep in it.
And are you done for this year? Like you're complete. What do you have left? The Arizona stuff.
Yeah, I just got done with Arizona coos deer, and then my niece. For all my nieces and nephews, I take them on a trip for their high school graduation rather than fly back to Minnesota and be one of 500 people they're trying to talk to.
Yeah.
So my niece really loves to hunt. She finally drew Wyoming elk.
All right. And
so she went to 4 years of college and been a teacher for 2 years before she finally drew. So a 6 year late high school graduation present. And the only time she can do it is over her Christmas recess. So we're going between Christmas and New Year. So I got that. And then I have an archery javelina tag in Arizona.
As so. Trail says, they are built to be bow hunted.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, javelina built for bow hunting.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, we've been all over. We started the season this year up in the Northwest Territories.
Saw that.
Yeah.
Went
spectacular.
Well.
Just beyond anything that I could have ever imagined. I'd never been to the Mackenzie Mountains, but I dreamed of it for 40 years, and it exceeded all expectations.
Did you see any wolves?
I did not.
Really?
No. Our guest hunter, Andy, when they were out, they saw a wolverine came right up to them. And then we did see one grizzly bear. The group before us saw, I think they said 15 or 16 grizzly bears on their 12-day hunt.
Wow.
We only saw one. But we saw a lot of sheep and we saw a lot of mountain caribou, and that's what we were there for. That's
awesome. But no wolves, huh? Did they kill the wolverine?
No, they didn't. We didn't have...
That's the only tag I haven't filled in Canada.
It's like the
gray ghost for me.
Yeah. Wolverine, huh?
Yeah, I mean, how cool would it be to kill a wolverine? And I always get one of the tags just to have, you know? You never know.
Yeah.
But I've never even seen one.
And that's the mistake
killed wolves,
we made.
Killed everything else, but...
We didn't get the wolverine tags.
Yeah. That's what, it's one of those things. It's like
you don't want to spend $20 on something when you spent however many thousands for one of those.
Well, it's like Nevada with the over-the-counter lion tags. Like, why not? You know?
Yeah.
So $20, put a wolverine tag. It's like, man, that'd be awesome to have a wolverine pelt. And I've never even seen one. Been up there.
Cool
shit, I've been up there five times now.
Mm-hmm.
Never even seen one.
Yeah, my dad's the only one I know who's actually bought a tag and
killed
successfully
it.
Taken a wolverine. Yeah.
Wow,
it's awesome. I want to kill one pretty bad. That'd be awesome.
You're hunting sheep and caribou?
Mountain caribou.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got a mountain caribou problem.
I think they're so gorgeous.
They are. And they're so big.
Santa's
going to
be so mad at you. No presents for Randy.
Yeah. And so when I came back from the Mackenzies, my wife, she said, I've never heard you so enamored about a landscape ever in your life. Everybody you talk to, I've never heard you this wound up. I'm like, well, it's that remarkable. And she said, well, you ought to go back. I said, honey, have you looked at my hunting account? There's $0 left in the hunting account. And she said, well, I'm pretty sure the household account could pay for that.
Hell yeah. Sign me up.
The household account, huh?
Yeah.
You're like, where's that account been in my whole life? Yeah.
Wait,
what account?
I can use this one for
hunting. We have a whole other account?
Yeah. So I emailed the outfitter. Said, well, if you ever have a cancellation, you know, at least just for mountain caribou, I'd probably do that. Maybe if you have a cancellation. Well, he just emailed me.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, yeah, I got a cancellation for 2026. And so I told my wife, and she's like, well, how much are they? And I told her, and she's like, well, you better do that. You might not get to do that again. So I'm suspicious that right now she's down here in Vegas with
doing
me.
What
she might
she
be
wants
down
now.
There at that whatever mall. I don't know. Maybe she's buying a timeshare or something.
Yeah. How many days did you have on your cancellation notice?
Well, it's actually in 2026.
Oh, yeah.
He just picked up another one.
I thought this one was cancellation.
No, this one we'd done as a sweepstakes for the Arizona Big Horn Sheep Society, because in COVID, they have one event a year, and in the COVID year 2020, Arizona just shut everything down. So that was their big fundraiser for the year, and Brad Renfrey called me. Actually, he saw me at the sheep show in Reno, and he said, hey, would you do a sweepstakes for us? I'm like... yeah, but I don't really know. What are you thinking? And as quick as he said Mackenzie Mountains, I'm like,
yep,
I'm in. But under the condition that I get to pay for my own hunt, I've been saving for that forever, and I got the money, and this is a fundraiser. So this isn't a Randy gets a free sheep hunt thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's like, Well, that's even better yet.
So. I had 2.5 days notice on my Northwest Territories hunt.
Oh,
now,
wow.
Granted, it's not a true 2.5 days because my dad was already going.
Oh, my dad
doesn't. He loves hunting with me or my brother, all of us together. Mm-hmm. And he was going up by himself. So he kept hounding the outfitter like, hey, if you ever have another tag, let me know. Right. I'll bring my son with me. So anyways, 2.5 days before my dad was leaving, he called me. He goes, they got a cancellation. I'm like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Sign me up. So I had 2.5 days to get ready. Luckily, that was the year we were prepping for a backcountry Colorado hunt.
Oh, yeah.
So I was already, my gear, everything ready. I'm like, hell yeah, let's do this.
Yeah.
2.5 days, that was awesome.
Well,
Zero to 100 real quick.
I did tell the outfitter that if you called me within 48 hours, I could be here. Mm-hmm. There is nothing on my calendar.
Yeah.
I have no weddings, funerals, or business event. There is nothing on my calendar that would even reach in the top 10 of what I would cancel to come back. So
that's awesome.
Has that changed for you through your career? Like the older you've gotten, and do you look back? Like, I'm curious as to like what hindsight is like for you, 2020, looking back. Do you wish that you would have taken more of those opportunities earlier?
Yeah, I do. I just turned 60 last month, and there's something about turning 60 that when you see that six in front of your age, it's like, man, I see a lot of obituaries with a six in front of them. But it has caused me to think about it a lot, Trail. And being an accountant inherently as a CPA, you're kind of probably a tightwad. And you're always saving and saving and getting it for this and for this. And like the money I use that kind of justified some of my Canada trips, I'd been saving for 30 years.
Right.
But now I look at the rate of inflation on those hunts. My hunting account did not earn anywhere near the returns that the rate of inflation was on those hunts.
Hmm.
Not that I need to go stone sheep hunting. I'd love to go stone sheep hunting, but it would have been smarter to go and do that 25 years ago when those hunts were $10,000 than now when they're pushing $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of it is, I consider it's lucky that I can still do it at 60.
Yeah.
That's kind of the for granted thing we always kind of disregard is, there's a lot of people out there who had a dream of someday, and they didn't make it to someday. Either they're not with us or they're with us today. But
their body isn't.
Exactly. They ended up with an ailment or something. So, looking back, I feel really blessed that I was able to get through that tube and those dreams became reality, but I would do it a lot differently with the benefit of hindsight.
I turned 45 this year. This has been the first year for me. I don't know why. It's the first, and my dad's had some health issues, but it's been the first year for me where I'm like, man, this thing I love to do it's not going to last forever, and you start thinking about the number of tags that you might have over time. And I'm thinking, man, some of these opportunities I just thought were out there someday I would do them. I probably need to start really getting serious about it and clicking them off my list,
And when you're raising kids and everything, you got those obligations and those worries and stuff. So I get it. But I could have done it sooner.
Yeah.
And I wish I would have, but
I didn't even think about the cost being $10,000 versus, 50 or 60,000 and difference. Yeah, I didn't even think about that before I asked the question.
Stones aren't that, though.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm putting...
It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, a doll. So what are you, a doll sheep now, guided fully? 30, 40, maybe?
Yeah.
I mean, whereas I remember that many years ago, I had buddies that went on cancellation hunts that were 14, 15, maybe.
Yeah.
That live in my neighborhood that put together enough money that they could go and do it.
And there's a couple of things that are driving that, talking to a lot of the outfitters, is, Alaska's had some really hard winters.
Mm-hmm.
Three of the last five or six winters have just hammered the rams, the dull sheep in Alaska. And the numbers just aren't there. When you're saying, we got to count, I think in Alaska, they got to be 8 or a full curl or double broom.
Yeah.
A lot of those rams have died off.
Hmm.
And so that's pushing a lot of people over to Canada. Well, in Canada, they're only allotted so many tags. Mm-hmm. So now you have a much bigger pool of people competing for them. And then you look at mountain caribou. The reason they've gotten so expensive is British Columbia used to have a lot of mountain caribou hunting. Mm-hmm. I think in the last year, the year before, they cut it down to where they're just now maybe 100 plus or minus a few tags for non-residents for mountain caribou. So all of a sudden, non-residents in the U.S. are like, I better go do that if I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
And I think that most of the outfitters in Canada right now are booking. This year, they'll start booking for 2028.
Oh, wow.
Everybody's sold out through 2027 for sheep. And I think they're going to start opening those 2028 hunts at close to 50,000. So I'm glad when we spoke for this hunt back in 2020.
Yeah.
Because with Canada closing the border, we were supposed to go in 21. Uh-huh. Well, the border was closed, so they rolled us to 22. Well, then they closed the border in 21, so they rolled us to this year. But the price was way more reasonable than it is right now. Yeah,
2020 price sounds fantastic right now.
Yeah. No, I'm talking like in those, if you were to go sign up today and you're going to get a hunt in 2028, you're going to pay more than double what we paid for that hunt that we just did this year that we signed up for in 2020. Yeah,
wow. It's wild.
How do you pair that as far as like those types of hunts, as far as like budgeting them and with your the normal stuff that you try to do? Mm-hmm. Do you have a priority list, I assume? So that's the priority right now, right? You put your money and time towards that. Do you still play the game in every other state?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I just love
What would it take to knock that hunt off? Like what tag would you have to have drawn in the lower 48 to say I'm not going woodland caribou hunting?
I'd have to finally, after many years of foolish gambling, draw the Arizona statewide pronghorn hunt.
Yeah, there we go. So that's my kind of answer.
So far from what I thought.
That is my kind of answer.
Man, you just got all kinds of surprising answers.
So I know this is going to sound weird, but Arizona gives one raffle super tag for pronghorn. And this is how much I am, I guess, afflicted by pronghorn problems. Every year, I go and look at what the draw odds were last year for that, because they published the odds. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure I have at least 1% draw odds every year. So I buy 1% of whatever the tags were last year. Mm-hmm. And I think that I keep building the number higher and higher by my contribution to it. So the next year I got to buy. So when my son had his elk tag in Arizona in September, you got to be physically in Arizona to buy those tags. Mm-hmm. You can't just buy them online. So I am standing in Arizona and I buy it and I screenshot the time on my receipt. And if you guys go look at your maps, you're going to see a waypoint of where I was standing at that same exact point in time, because I paid whatever it was for 1% odds in the Arizona.
Statewide antelope.
Statewide. I don't care about their sheep, their mule deer, their elk, statewide, nothing.
I love it. That's my kind of tag.
Yeah. But then when I was down coos deer hunting last week, I got to looking at the numbers. I'd kind of guessed it on the 2022 numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I looked at the 2023. I'm like, oh, man, I got to buy another 10 or 11 tags to be at my chances.
Get your percentage up.
Oh.
But when I look at, I've been doing that for like 20 years.
Wow.
Really? And you haven't drawn it yet, huh?
No, I've never drawn.
Yeah, probably never will.
I probably never will. Yeah. But that's probably the one thing.
Pronghorn problems.
What do you like about pronghorn? You say you got a pronghorn problem.
Everything about them. How they taste, how they act, the places they live, the fact that there's really no other species, no animal that you're going to go anywhere else and hunt that is like a pronghorn.
Yeah.
And I get that some people are, well, yeah, I go fill my tag in a half hour. That's cool. I mean, great. You can.
Mm-hmm.
But much like seeing all these ones Lorenzo has on the wall out here, you kind of get out of it what you want to make of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've put my mind in places where I've made it into way more than it really needed to be, but I sure had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's what it's exactly that. You can get out of it what you put into it.
Yeah.
Like big pronghorn hunting is fun.
Yeah.
I mean, there's legitimately two different types of pronghorn hunting. It's either you know, you go fill a tag and have fun in the truck with a bunch of people, or you go hunt it for a big animal, and it's still a ton of fun and a completely different hunt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's awesome.
I think the other part of it, and I didn't realize this until we're doing a video. My son and I drew in Utah 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and I burned 25 points. He burned 15 points. And the crew was asking me, all right, what's the story? Let's just roll back the layers, and where does this come from? So I had to think about it. I said, I'll let you know tomorrow. I'll go think about it. And what it comes to, I think, is the very first big game hunt I did in the West, in Montana, was pronghorn. Mm-hmm. And here's Matthew, my son, this little snotty-nosed two-year-old, pulling on these pronghorn horns. Yeah. And I got to looking at every pronghorn hunt. There's him and my wife there with me. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the most unbelievable memories mm-hmm. that I have about hunting. And these weren't huge pronghorn, but pronghorn was something that a whole family could go out and do. Mm-hmm. The weather was usually somewhat tolerable. You got a two-year-old, five-year-old, whatever. You're not walking them 4 miles up a 30-degree slope, you know.
Yep.
When I think about it, that's probably what really buried the needle for me in pronghorn. It was something my family and I just did.
I think as just pure aesthetics, I think they're one of the most striking animals on the Western landscape. Yeah. We had Doug Champion, who's a rodeo, you know, rider and fitness guy. We had him in the office yesterday, and we walked down to Lorenzo's office. He's obviously got a nice herd of antelope on his wall, and we looked at those, and he was like, I need to hunt antelope. He says, yeah, they're kind of neat looking, but I was thinking about it. It just kind of brought me back in him saying that, but honestly don't think there's anything more striking than like early morning light on that landscape with the desert and the grass
and the black alien face looking at you.
And that light catches their hide and their hair, and they're just so striking. And then just their behavior. They're so fun to watch.
They are so goofy.
just fun to watch. Yeah. It's like, I get that. I don't know about woodland caribou. I don't know if I give that up, but statewide Arizona, that might be tempting.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm going to my grave without. I've never drawn a sheep tag, and I'm probably never going to draw that Arizona statewide pronghorn tag. But I'm going down trying.
Yeah,
love it.
Since we had Doug here yesterday, I've been thinking. Last night I was doing a little reading about Doug, some more reading, and was writing the podcast description and just kind of look at his fitness page. But you've been doing this year Mountaintop Fitness.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How long have you been doing that?
Started a year ago, actually, first week of December last year. It's funny, Marcus, who worked for us, he did it the year before because he had a Montana sheep tag. And in his polite way of seeing how maybe I'm not investing in my health and my hunting the way I should, and then I messed up my arm 2 years ago, and so I babied that and threw atrophy and everything. After the season was over last year, he said, you know, I think you'd benefit from Mountain Tough. I did that the last year, and I think you'd benefit from that. Polite way of saying, hey, Randy, you're getting old and out of shape, and we're tired of waiting for you when we're hiking up the mountain. So I went over there. They're right across the road from me. I've known those guys since they opened up over there. And Dustin and Sarah and them, they do an original or initial assessment. And I'm sure their thought was, this guy ain't going sheep hunting.
Was there any intimidation doing that, going into that?
Yeah, like for, there is.
That's, I mean, me too.
I'm an accountant, right? I'm not a gym rat. But what I realized is they're not this traditional gym rat kind of thing where there's a bunch of muscle heads there flexing and doing whatever. It's more built for people who travel a lot. How do you stay on a program in spite of your travel and your busy calendar? And we did that, and it started working really good. And then they said, we have an idea. We're going to do a 9-week, 50-plus preseason prep class, and you're going to be the talent.
Oh, shit.
I'm like, what? I came home for dinner that night, and we're talking about how our day went. And I said, honey, you aren't going to believe this. The folks at Mountain Tough want to do a 9-week online fitness course with me. And she almost spit out whatever she was eating. She's just like trying not to laugh. But I stuck with it. And I guess what it reminded me, and we all know this, right? Because when we're younger and we're more fit, and we can really get after it. Even though if we don't have the mental toughness, we certainly have the physical stamina that over time kind of dissipates. It was that reminder of how much more fun I have when I'm in better shape. The hunt in the Northwest Territories, even though that's a horseback hunt, when you go hunt that country, you look at it, and it is some of the newest, just jagged, rugged landscape on the North American continent. And a year ago, I would have been looking at some of those and say, boy, I hope it's a 12-day hunt, but I hope I only have to do 2 or 3 stalks because that's probably all I got in me. Mm-hmm. Now, every day I'd wake up, I'm like, let's go. If I was going to do 12 stalk, you know, a stalk a day, because you're lucky to get a stalk. They're such long stalks. It takes a whole day. I would have done a stalk every day and had a smile the whole time. So it just has reminded me that you're going to have more fun when you're out there doing it in a way that
you're
just in better shape. And I think it's better for your whole body, your whole life. You know?
How many days did you work out then?
5 days a week.
5 days a week.
Yeah, take Saturday and Sunday off. Yeah. And, you know, you guys know that my wife's family's from Vegas, and so I end up here way more than I... A little bit of Vegas goes a long way with me anymore. But I could tell you at every hotel the quality of their gym.
Their gym. That's awesome.
Like, the new one down here, the Durango, and Red Rock have the best gyms in Vegas.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
Are you doing cardio? Are you doing full body stuff? Did they kind of hook you up with programs that you know how to follow?
Yeah, they're like, okay, if you're traveling and you don't have dumbbells and you don't have a step-up box and other stuff, here's the things you do. Mm. And it's mostly just, you know, body weight workouts.
Gotcha.
And it works. But one of the things I've realized after I did 3 weeks pronghorn hunting, I wasn't in mountain shape anymore. I was in prairie shape. I told the guy, I went over there. I said, guys, I'm prairie tough right now.
You're like a long distance runner.
I need to get back in it. But no, it was a big help. And it's something I've just now blocked out those points in my day where I'm going to do it until they put me in the dirt. Just because it's good for... For
good
every
for
part
everything.
Of our,
good for
our mental, lives.
During the day, good for everything.
Yeah, good for your head.
Yeah.
There's
They have Kyle, a nutritionist there, and I got an hour session with him. And I knew all this stuff, but he had just had some little tweaks and pieces about stuff. And, you know, now when we land here on an airplane, I head down to a grocery store and, you know, make sure I got some good stuff to eat for breakfast and for lunch and for snacks instead of.
That's a really hard part of traveling.
It is.
It's like that should be everyone's first stop is a grocery store, but who the hell wants to do that after you just got done traveling?
Yeah. So it's like everything in life, you know, it requires just a little bit more commitment, but the results are better than just a little bit more.
I thought it was really cool that you did it.
I thought so too. I liked watching it.
Here's the thing, like and this is no offense to Dustin and those guys because they're great dudes, and that's a great group of people, and they do what they do, and you know he's an incredibly strong, fit guy.
Yeah.
But like, I'm not going to watch a lot of their content or other people's content that fit that mold because I'm just like, that's not me. But I watch Randy. I'm like, I want to watch Randy work out.
I completely
because
agree.
I relate to it more. I'm like, Randy's doing it. Randy's a little bit older than me, and if he's doing it every day, there's this thing in it for me. I'm like, oh man, I gotta get my shit together. I gotta do it. Randy's doing it.
Yeah. When they told me how many people were signing up and how much, because you go on their platform and they can track where people are, what parts of the platform people are spending time on. They told me the numbers. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. My brother is a logger back in Minnesota, and he's got a crew of guys who work for him. And they were talking about it, and he said one of his buddies called him and said, hey, I signed up for that thing your brother's doing. He's 12 years older than me. He's full of crap. He isn't doing this. There's no way. It'd kill him. I've been doing it for like a week, and I'm giving up. I can't tough it out. They're making this up. Like, okay, whatever. But it was a fun process to go through, and if it motivates just a few people my age or, you know, who are dealing with a health issue to just... Yeah, and I don't care if it's hunting, if it's just their life. You know, you want to have as you get older, the quality of your day start because of health issues. Yep. I mean, someone who's 80 is going to have a harder time having a great quality of life health-wise than someone who's 25. Mm-hmm. That's just life. So if you want to keep that quality of life there, you got to put something into it, and that's what I've committed to going mm-hmm. forward. So.
That's good.
I thought it was cool. I thought the other part of that whole thing is, I think the thing that I actually I admire quite a bit about you is I think you put yourself out there. Like you're not afraid to be Randy. You know, it's like
you're pretty vulnerable.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think about me going to the gym. So like Lorenzo invites me to the gym. Lorenzo runs a 10K with me this year. You know, we go to Cam Haynes's camp. He's like, I'm gonna run the 10K, and then he's like,
and I don't run. I'm like, yeah, adamantly
and I don't lift. And I don't lift. So then Lorenzo's like, hey, you need to come to the gym with me. I'm like, not only no, but hell no. Like, I'm not doing that because I'm not putting myself out there like that. I'm not going to expose myself. So I thought it was really cool that you were, you know, vulnerable enough that you're like, I'm just going to go do it.
Yeah.
So I thought that was super commendable.
I can assure you guys that when you get to be a certain age, vanity goes out the window.
I've never seen Randy in shorts either until I saw that.
Well, you can see that not many people
that guy's
have seen
definitely
me in
from
shorts.
Minnesota.
And without a ball cap. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I had no doubts about you being from the north after seeing that.
Randy and Brady, I don't think I ever see the two of you without a ball cap on.
It's a true statement. Yeah. It's very true.
It's got a great head of hair, too.
Oh, yeah, he does. Look at that. Yeah, perfect head of hair.
I got a head of hair like that.
You know, the glare off all that silver hair is bad for camouflage. I got to wear a hat or I'll scare off all the critters.
Looks good. Looks good.
No, it's been a great season. I'm sure most seasons won't replicate the way they have.
Yeah.
You know, I got to do two hunts with my son that were just fantastic, fun hunts that we didn't see either of them coming. But some years, you know, if you keep applying and applying, every once in a while, your numbers are going to get going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And usually you get one of those a year, not two of them.
Yeah.
So
when he was growing up and he was a kid, did you ever struggle with, like, I don't know, a feeling of like wanting to hunt for yourself and then also feeling, you know, quote unquote obligated to get your kid and take your kid? Cause I wouldn't sugarcoat it. Taking your kids is hard work.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of work and a lot of fun. And I think this year, I mean, I've taken my oldest kid quite a bit, but this year I took my 12-year-old on a deer hunt and, you know, we killed a buck. We hunted 2 days and, this is probably like one of the first ones I can look back and I'm like, you know what? I did something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It felt really good. I felt like I took him and he got a lot out of it, but I often wonder, cause I also struggle. I'm like, I also just want 10 days to myself to go out and chase elk with a bow and try to kill the best bull I can.
Yeah. No, I went through those same struggles.
Yeah.
But for me, I saw growing up, I saw a lot of adults really go out of their way to help make sure that the kids or the grandkids or the nieces or nephews got to hunt. And so that's always struck with me. So it was pretty easy. And there's one time I really remember a bunch of my buddies were going pheasant hunting in central Montana. And it was a great pheasant year. And we had just, the year before, got a dog. And he was helping train it. He's 6 or 7 years old. And I'd promised him that next weekend we'd go out pheasant hunting locally, which is hard around Bozeman. And he hears me on the phone with my buddies, and they're inviting me to go on this amazing pheasant hunt. And he's just kind of looking at me like,
what are you going to do?
Puppy dog eyes. Yeah.
What are you going to do?
And so I said, no, guys, thanks, but I promised Matthew. And so we went out. It was about 30 degrees, kind of spitting snow and rain. It was so miserable. And he traipsed along through the cattails and the grass with that dog, and we didn't see a pheasant until maybe 200 yards on our way back to the truck. the dog dives in the cattails, rooster flushes, and fortunately I finally made a decent shot. Down it goes. I still have that picture, him standing by this fence mm-hmm. post holding this pheasant with his dog beside him. Mm-hmm. And everything in that picture epitomizes why I made that decision and why I think to this day he's as much about hunting as I am, about conservation, about all the other things. And yeah, he's more into bird hunting than I am, and I'm more into big game hunting than he is. But that was the best investment.
That's awesome.
That it was just, asking me earlier about things I'd look back on. Looking back on that, investing that time in my child to become a hunter was the best investment I ever made in any of my hunting. Mm. Not even, there's nothing even nothing comes close to that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm hearing you talk. I'm trying to talk myself into retaining the perspective.
Well, like I talk Trail all the time too. He tells me these stories with his kids. I'm like, man, I cannot wait until my kid is old enough, because I can take him a little hunting. You know, he's seen some antelope get killed. He's seen some easy like elk, you know, the truck hunting style getting killed. But I want to take him on a real hunt. So I listen to his stories. I'm like, man, I can't wait. But then I hear Trail, and I'm like, ah, I see where you're coming from, too. I'm still going to want to hunt for myself. Yeah. You know? That's a tough, like, I'm already thinking about that.
They're kind of opposite ends of the spectrum sometimes is the type of hunt that they can be. Right. So, yeah, there's just, like, I still battle. I really want to try to achieve and do, you know, chase my own dreams and my own goals, you know, and then, you know, also take your kids and get them out. But, I battle with that.
You have an army of them.
Yeah, three.
All boys.
All boys. Yeah,
no,
for sure.
I just think when you make that decision that you're going to have kids, you just make the investment whenever you can in whatever way you can. And I went through those same struggles. I fully get it. But I always tried to find a way to take him with. Like, we've got pictures of us, pronghorn hunting. Mm-hmm. One time we went and my wife shot a really nice whitetail. I'm like, well, don't shoot that one over there. She's looking over here, and she offhands at 150 yards. Boom, I got him. I'm like, no, he's still standing there because I saw this little buck. Mm-hmm. Well, he was with us. He's about 4 or 5, and he's sitting on top of the. I mean, the pictures we have, you can tell. Here's this like kid, looks like a jack-o'-lantern. And he's just having the time of his life out there. It's snowing and cold, and he just. Think about those kind of things, and then also the life skills that I think come from hunting. You know, failure. You know, most days we're not going to get something.
Yep.
There's a lot of things we can't control. Well, guess what? You know, you might, as a 6-year-old, the world might tell you can control everything, but you go out hunting, you realize you can't control the weather, you can't control the hunting pressure, you can't control the animals. So there's all these other life skills that they get to watch and observe at a very young age that I think are helpful and distinguish what path or how they're going to grow to be adults that maybe we're really not even seeing at the time. But I can look back at that and I can tell you taking your kids hunting is going to teach them life skills that nothing else that they're going to do at school or elsewhere is going to teach them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say even more so now, because when they are here, they're so plugged into electronics and the internet and any answer to any question. I was doing, this is embarrassing, but I was doing 9th grade math with my, ninth grader. So he was behind in math and we sat down, the two of us, and we worked on math. And I'm terrible at math, but it was crazy to me. Like he could do his work, then he could take the same equation, punch it into an app on his phone. It would kick out every single step with the answer, right? So he could check his answer. But like he could do that in 30 seconds. But I mean, like actual problem solving anymore, there's not a lot of it that has to be done that you can't do on your own with your phone.
Yeah, you can find everything on the internet.
You can do anything. It's so easy. So I think you're right. There's like hunting is a situation where it's like, okay, there's not really an answer to this. We got to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, imagine when your kid finds ChatGPT.
Oh, yeah, they found it.
Can literally
I mean,
anything in life.
Yeah.
But you can't plug in, hey, there's an elk at 1,000 yards.
Yeah, how do I get closer to it?
How do I get there?
Yeah.
Can't
how
give
do,
you that
how
answer.
How do I figure out wind and topography and, you know, how do I build a fire and all those kinds of things. Yeah. That was one thing my kid said when I took him was, it was his own observation. He just said, I haven't even thought about my phone or the phone for 2 days, you know? And I was like, man, I'm not doing a very good job as a dad, one, if you're on it that much. And then two, that's a pretty cool observation for a 12-year-old kid to say, huh, I'm on my phone too much. But
yeah.
Did you, I was curious. So I think people, when you guys think of Randy Newberg, what do you think? Like the name Randy Newberg.
OG
like what do you equate it with?
Yeah. Salt of the earth, conservationist.
Yeah. Conservationist, right? Yeah,
that's like, I think that's what comes to mind.
Do you think most
mind.
People would say that about you at this point?
I hope so.
Yeah.
That's the goal. It's very obvious by my physical traits, by everything, that I'm not God's gift to hunting. But it doesn't matter how skilled you are, or what level of condition you're in, you can have a passion for hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a passion for hunting, hopefully, and that's the whole idea behind our platforms, is it leads you to the place of conservation. Because I would not have had the life of hunting that I've had if not for affirmative decisions by people who came before me, whether it was at my dad and mom's generation, my grandparents' generation, all the way along there, people were making decisions and standing up and speaking and donating and contributing in a way, maybe it was small to them, but the cumulative effect of millions of hunters doing that made those opportunities available for me. And that's my goal in life. It has been since I can remember. I've always been involved in that. And I know some people think like, that's pretty old school, Randy. And maybe it is, but it just, if 100 years, 200 years, 500 years from now, America doesn't have a place of public lands and places and doesn't have the general populace as hunters, it's not going to be the America that I could envision. It's going to be a different country that, and so none of that happens by accident. It requires millions of people donating what they can in terms of their time, their talent, their money. And I've kind of developed three principles to that I always remind myself, is that conservation is never easy. I say if it was easy, they'd call it golf. And all the golfers get upset. It's always kind of uncomfortable, is the term I always use, because no matter what position I advocate for, someone's upset with me.
Yeah.
Maybe it's an old classmate picks up the phone. Hey, I heard what you wrote about that or said on that. I don't agree with you. You know, or maybe it's a coworker or a neighbor. And it's always inconvenient. You know, imagine if when the Pittman-Robertson Act came into existence in 1937, if Key Pittman, senator here in Nevada, would have said, you know, I'm just too busy today. I'm not going to worry about that. Or when, you know, some big public land event added a bunch of access, the people who pulled it off said, we're just too busy today. You know, that wasn't on my calendar. A lot of the stuff we enjoy today wouldn't be here. So it's uncomfortable, it's difficult, and it's inconvenient. But once you accept that that's just part of the game, you just take it in stride and hopefully you stay committed to it.
Yeah.
So
do you remember at what point that became more prominent?
Yep.
For you, because the thing I was thinking about as we were, you know, I knew you'd be here today, myself included. I know a lot of people that hunt, a lot of people in my neighborhood hunt, friends, family, a lot of people hunt, but I wouldn't necessarily put all those in a box of conservation, nor have I ever had a conversation with them about conservation specifically. Right. It's usually like, where are you applying? You know, how, you know, did you find a 180 buck, antelope, where's an 80 incher, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of sportsmen, there's a lot of hunters, but not all sportsmen doesn't feel like are conservation minded. And so I felt like, man, we have this like ginormous pool of people that it felt like if we all became a little bit more conservation minded, a little bit more clued in, like we could probably end up getting a whole hell of a lot more done than what we are.
Yeah.
So what was it for you that like tripped the trigger? How do we talk to those people?
It's a whole series of things in your life. You don't realize that a lot of seeds are getting planted along the way. And then there's like some event that fertilizes those seeds and all of a sudden, whatever it is starts to grow. And for me, some of those seeds were growing up. The whole community, it was a logging town. So in the springtime, when the loggers all had the spring off because the swamps were thawing and you couldn't get out to the trees, it became tree planting. And when you're 6-7 years old and all your friends and everybody in town's out planting trees, you're like, well, that's what we do. Well, then you realize that the reason they're planting trees is so that they'd have some trees to cut 50 years from now. And things like that, growing up in a lifestyle like that. And then probably one of the trigger events was in 1990 when my son was born. All of a sudden, you just start thinking, anyone who's a parent realizes that how in 2 hours did my old lens, I can't find the old lens I used to look through to see life. So that was it. And then when my wife and I took these huge pay cuts to move to Montana in 1991, we moved there. We left Nevada for the fact that we get an elk tag every year. And a deer tag every year. And I mean, the pay cuts we took were combined household income went down 40%. So we show up, and within 2 years, right south of Bozeman, there was all checkerboard because there was an old railroad that went up to Gallatin Canyon. And some people bought that, and they said, you know what? We're closing off all these trails, and all this 40,000 acres we're done hunting. You're done hunting after next year. My wife reads that in the Bozeman Chronicle, and she said, there's a meeting going on at the Holiday Inn, whatever night, up at North 7th. Senator Baucus is going to be there. I want you to go there and tell him what I'm thinking. I still don't remember her saying that. I never know what you're thinking, honey. But anyhow, I went there because we didn't take these pay cuts, disrupt our whole lives, to now all of a sudden lose all this public access that was so important to the reason we moved there. I'm sitting in the back. I've only lived in Montana for a couple of years at this time, and I see all the hunters there. And then there's a bunch of, you know, if you want to call them more environmental type folks who they were up there ranting and raving and carrying on. And finally, Senator Baucus is like, anyone else got anything to say? And I'm like, well, are the hunters going to sit? Finally, yeah. No hunter. So I stood up. I don't even remember what I said. Other than a game and fish guy who has now retired from game and fish in Montana, he tells the story that I threatened to get Max Baucus fired that night. He said, he's the first guy I ever saw stand up and tell a U.S. senator, you're getting fired if you don't do this. But we ended up, I ended up being invited by the senator and a bunch of other people to be very involved in that. And we ended up getting all of that land accumulated and consolidated in a land exchange that netted 70-some thousand acres of additional public access by the time it was all done. And it was very meaningful to see that get pulled off. It seemed impossible to start with, but a lot of people worked at it. And you realize that, okay, it's maybe not the perfect solution, but it's a really good solution. And then I just ended up being involved in more of them. But I'd say that was a pivot point event.
Yeah. I think when you start to see like a little bit of, you show up to a meeting and you see some meaningful change or something doesn't change, right? So it's not developed, it's maintained for public access. Like you start to see those little wins. And I think like Colorado 127 this year, I think was one of those.
That was a big one.
Yeah. Yep. I think people for the first time saw, for a while anyway, that I can remember, it's like, man, we got together on an issue. We showed up, we spoke to our neighbors, we sent text messages and emails to our friends and family that live in Colorado. And we protected, you know, a way of life. We supported sound science. We supported hunting. I think like those little wins, man, they can really, I know for me personally, Brady had more posts on Instagram about that there through that month. You genuinely seemed very excited about it.
Something passionate about.
Yeah, something passionate about it. Yeah, sparked the word. Sparked a passion.
And, you know, I knew I was getting hate from it too. Took the hate for what it is and tried to educate people.
Yeah, but those grassroots movements like that, we need more of that. It feels like, you know, to get behind it and have those wins, and just when you start to see like real meaningful change happen, you're like, man, if we stick together and we have a voice, like we can do some really cool stuff, or at least protect our way of life.
If I had to look back, that was probably the big event.
Yeah.
I took 2 years of business and professional speaking in college. Mm-hmm. And so after I got up and spoke at that event, I was telling you, all the hunting communities are like, we're going to have this guy do our talking. We'll give him the talking points, but he's going to be our public speaker. So now all of a sudden I'm like, well, who the heck am I? I'm like a chucklehead here. You know, I'm 27 years old at the time, but people are like, here. You go do the talking. So I kind of got thrown into it that way, but the passion was always there.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, through accident, kind of stumbled into the way that I could make a meaningful contribution to it, along with all the great contributions so many other people make in mm-hmm. other ways. And it really became apparent to me that all this life I lived growing up, where my parents divorced when I was 10 or 11, thinking, oh, I'm never going to get to hunt because my dad had to move away for work. But I had public land mm-hmm. half mile from our trailer house.
Yeah.
Go home from school, grab that shotgun, and I'd go hunt grouse and rabbits. So, again, that's planting some seeds of how my life is going to be. And I don't realize it till later on when I moved to Montana, and there's a lot of no trespassing signs. Montana is 2/3 private. If it wasn't for that public land, I wouldn't be sitting here with you guys because I would have never got to be a hunter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm never going to give up the ship on public land.
Yeah.
Never.
That kind of seems to be the biggest, like, for you, right? Like, a big passion project would be public land and public land access.
Yeah, it is. Because, let's face it, the public lands gets a lot of pressure, and it's not the primest habitat, but it's a place where people can go. Mm-hmm. And it's a place where people can, you know, make a lot of mistakes in learning, and, you know, and in that process, they'll have success now and then, and it's gonna give them the opportunity to become hunters, or whatever it is. And, you know, how try to envision the conservation ethic of the United States without us having these public lands. How would we have a tangible connection to wild places and wild things?
Yeah, you wouldn't. You couldn't.
And so, if America is going to retain that conservation spirit that we gave the world back in the late 1800s, it's dependent upon Americans having places to hunt and fish. And so it's...
Yeah. It's, I know the older I've gotten, the more just perspective I've had on public. And I think maybe it is just you get a chance to travel a little bit. You get a chance to hunt in other states and kind of see different perspectives of what it's like to actually have public lands too, huh? I mean, growing up in Utah, we have a lot of public land, which I want to bring up Utah here. I'm headed there. I'm headed to see how I set that one up nice.
Oh, dang.
But I had a lot of public land to hunt. I didn't really ever think about it, but now, you know, I look at it and I bring up Utah. I mean, what are your thoughts on Utah and the land grab?
You know, that's so interesting because, like you and others I know from Utah, Utah folks love to hunt and fish.
Oh, man.
But their elected officials, at least some of them, have this craziness that they don't like public land. They just don't. And so right now, you know, they've filed that lawsuit with the Supreme Court asking that Utah be allowed to take control over 18.5 million acres of BLM land. Mm-hmm. And then it's been joined by a bunch of other states, and some of those states have said, we don't just want the BLM land. We want the national parks. We want the Forest Service. We want the national monument. We want it all. And, you know, when I first heard this idea of transferring the land to the state agencies, the state land boards, being a CPA, a small government guy, conservative, low tax guy, I'm like, yeah, that's a pretty good idea. And then I got to thinking, well, wait a second. In Colorado, on state lands, you can't hunt, fish, camp, hike, shoot. Arizona, you can't recreational shoot on state lands. Mm-hmm. Or I called here in Nevada, you guys had 2.1 million acres of state land. Now you got 3,000 acres.
Yeah.
So I called your state land people. I'm like, hey, can I hunt or shoot on your state lands? They're like, no. So you guys got what, 45 million acres of BLM land or something like that in Nevada? If that went to your state land board, you're not hunting or shooting on that. So yeah, all these folks who leave the Vegas area here and go out and do something. So, and I could go on and on and on, but we're talking about hundreds of millions of acres would then become off limits to recreational shooting. Same, you know.
Could. You're talking Utah, right? If they grab that?
Well, if it's held to be the case for Utah, it's got to be applied. The U.S. Supreme Court's going to apply it to every
across
state.
The board.
So it's not like they're just going to say, oh, yeah, Utah, you're special.
Yeah.
Because Utah has made the basis that the federal ownership of these lands is unconstitutional under their rationale that they've submitted. So if the U.S. Supreme Court says that, you can't just apply it to BLM lands. You got to apply it to all federal lands. And you can't just apply it to federal lands in Utah. You got to apply it to federal lands everywhere. So you extrapolate that out to what the states in the West have as these highly restricted state land policies. And we're going to lose hundreds of millions of acres to hunting and camping and recreational shooting.
Yeah.
I mean, even in Wyoming, you know, they let you hunt there. Because of your hunting license is part of that, I think, funds their state land board. But like Lorenzo and I went on a mule deer hunt there. Imagine if we had to hike in there and hike out every day because you can't camp on federal land under Wyoming.
You wouldn't have been able to hunt where we hunted.
No.
Because like, it was not like even close.
6 or 7 hour hike in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So how are you going to hunt the thoroughfare of Wyoming when you got to ride horse for 12 hours? And it's not like you can camp at a trailhead now because the trailhead is federal land. So no camping there when it becomes state land. You got to drive all the way from Cody out to where you're currently camping, and then you got to hike in. Walk that through and see just how much hunting you're going to get to do in Wyoming.
Yeah,
New Mexico, same thing. Can't camp on their lands. So state how are you going to hunt the Gila?
Yeah.
You can drive from Socorro or Daddle or somewhere every day. Hike in and then drive, hike out and then drive back that night?
Yeah.
And people haven't thought this out. And for me, what I think it represented, the other thing that concerns me is everybody wants better federal land management. Mm-hmm. Right? We were talking about the horse issue and all that stuff earlier. There's so many things we need to improve on federal land management, and Congress could fix every one of those. There's not a single thing we're frustrated with federal land management Congress couldn't fix. But rather than do that hard work, we want to take the lazy route, take our eye off the ball, and say, let's just give all this to the states.
Yeah.
Because we're too lazy to do the hard work that's necessary.
Yeah.
And so I think right now, if you look at where the political landscape is, there's a huge opportunity to improve federal land management through the litigation problems, through some of the crazy laws we have, through, you know, streamlining some processes. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Now's our time. Let's do it. And let's make these federal lands even more productive for wildlife and for the things we love. But no.
Yeah.
A lot of the people who for years have wanted to sell these federal lands have seized the opportunity and said, oh man, there's a good chance to sell these lands.
Yeah.
And that's in
so
the
is
long
that
term.
Utah's basis is they want to take it over to sell it?
Yeah. Because Utah's sold over 50% or sold about 50% of their state lands already.
Yeah. So I made this comment internally. We had a little discussion about it. And if you look at the kind of the track record of school trust lands, state lands in the state of Utah, you look at their track record, it's not great. It's like Randy's saying, they'll sell them off, they develop, they, you know, oil, gas, drilling. Really, I mean, if you look at state ownership of federal lands, to me, really the only driving force behind a state doing that is how can we economically benefit from that land that we are not currently economically benefiting from. Yeah. Otherwise, why else would they do? I mean, why?
That's what I'm running through in my head.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it's pretty well one-sided. I mean, it's driven, it's economics. We want to be able to sell it, develop it. We need, I think even within the statement when they submitted it, it was, you know, we need more housing.
Right.
You know, okay, well, if we take back federal lands, then we can sell it off and build houses on it, you know, which to me is like, it's not good for wildlife. It's not
it's a good way to just eliminate hunting off the landscape.
Yeah.
So all those anti-groups are like, hey, we're going to support this. That means no more people can be hunting on these lands anymore, which is going to...
Yeah. To me, it seems very... I mean, it's interesting. If you read through their plan, they're basically saying the state of Utah, they're going to develop this Utah Land Management Agency, which is going to be a facsimile or something similar to a federal agency that would oversee the land. But then how do you manage that? Where do you get the budget for it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if it goes to state ownership, you're then only, you only have the state funding to manage that land, whereas federally you have this pool, right, mm-hmm. that you can manage the landscape. And then to me, it just, I don't like it. And
how would that work with the Pittman Act being federal, but a state owning, how would that work? They haven't thought any of that through.
No one's thought that through. Everyone says, oh, well, we'll worry about that. We'll change that law when the time comes. It's like, yeah, right. Sure.
Yeah.
So the folks, and I have the charts. I've went through every state from every western state. Utah was granted at statehood 7.4 million acres. So the federal government said, here, 7.4 million acres, use this to fund your schools. They sold, or they currently only have 3.3 million left. So they've sold 55% of them. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the Utah State Land Board website right now, they just had a big auction in November. And the average person in my audience is not the one bidding on those properties.
Mm-hmm.
And they're running out of real attractive inventory. And so you look at some of these other states, California has sold 92% of their lands that they were granted at statehood. Nevada has sold 99.87%. The strip right here that now sells for, you know, it's in the tens of millions per acre. A lot of that was state land, and it got sold for a couple bucks an acre back in the early 1900s. North Dakota has sold 78% of theirs. Oregon has sold 79% of those. South Dakota sold 78% of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So the groups that have been behind this idea of selling the public lands in the 80s said, let's just sell the public lands. Well, they got their teeth kicked in. I'm like, well, that wasn't a good idea. We need a better marketing package. So they pop up with some new ideas. Well, about 10 or 15 years ago, they come up with the idea of, let's transfer them to the state land boards, because statutorily the state land boards have to dispose of any land that's not producing a profit.
Yes. Yeah, so the state of Utah, the law actually reads, by state law, state lands must be managed in the most prudent and profitable manner possible. So they have to be managing it for profit.
Right. Yeah. And if it's not, they have to sell them. By law, they have to sell them. So the groups who want to get rid of public lands, and there's been a movement of people who hate public lands going back into the 1800s. And they're like, well, if we gave them to the states, they'd have to sell hundreds of millions of acres. Mission accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And look, right now everyone's frustrated with the damn feds and da-da-da. And yep, they're right. Everyone is frustrated with them. So really, it's not about better management. If these folks in Congress and some of these people who are promoting this really cared about better management, we got tons of ways to start on that.
That's the thing that ticks me off about the state of Utah. It's like, we're going to pay lawyers to litigate. We're going to sue the federal government for land transfer, federal lands to state, where in reality, we could take that money and hire lawyers to sue the federal government on behalf of issues that actually matter.
Yeah. I've yet to talk to a hunter from Utah who says, we just got too damn much access in this state.
Yeah.
And so...
What do you think people can do? What should people do?
They need to be getting in touch with their elected officials. And I know that sounds like ninth grade civics.
Mm-hmm.
But if you live in Wyoming, your legislature just joined and signed an amicus brief saying, hey, we're all on board with Utah, but we want the parks and we want the national monuments and we want the Forest Service lands.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a state, Wyoming, where you can't camp on state lands. So how are you and I going to go do another one of those deer hunts again?
Yeah.
So you need to be contacting your elected officials in those states.
Yeah.
Even some states like Alabama and Iowa and South Carolina, states that have hardly any public land, decided, we'll sign on that. And here's really, people are like, well, why would they do that? So a lot of people just aren't into this issue like all of us mm-hmm. are and some other people. So in the world of politics, if you don't know about an issue, you call someone who you think might know about it. Well, the people who get called, there's a couple think tanks on this stuff in Utah. So, well, let's call them. Well, those think tanks are all about selling the public land, so that's who they get their information from. Mm-hmm. And if one of their constituents who understood this and was passionate about it called them or met with them and said, hey, I know you might have been told this, but let me tell you how this is going to affect my hunting or my fishing or whatever. Most of these people would be like, oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah. That, I think the other thing is to ask the shooting industry, you know, where are you guys on this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because we would lose more acreage to recreational shooting under this than we would to hunting.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Arizona, I mean, there's big signs on Arizona state land. No target shooting. Yeah. Even if you buy their recreation permit, you cannot target shoot or recreational shoot mm-hmm. in Arizona. And right now they have 9.2 million acres.
Yeah.
Just in Arizona. California, well, they've sold most of theirs, so it doesn't matter quite that much. But if you think about what if these became federal lands, became state lands,
mm-hmm.
in California, we're talking about 45 million acres that no longer can you recreational shoot on.
Yeah.
In Colorado, we're talking 23 million acres.
I just I just haven't ever seen the direction from anytime state owns land. You brought up Colorado, for example. I've just never seen it work out for the good of most, you know, public land hunters, public right. land access, public land recreation. It just doesn't seem to work out
yeah.
in their best interest. It feels like to me it only is limited.
Yeah.
To me.
So I think right now we have a huge opportunity to do so many good things on public land management.
Mm-hmm.
You know, regardless of what people think about this election or that election, the reality is right now there's an opportunity to do some good things out there.
Mm-hmm.
But if all we're going to do is just say, let's give up the ship, let's just give it away.
Yeah.
We're going to lose that opportunity. And the analogy I always use is, you know, the public lands of America, if you thought of it as a big commercial rental complex and you were the owner and your property manager wasn't doing a good job, would you just give that commercial property away and say, hell with it, I'm just going to give it to somebody else? Mm-hmm. Or would you tell your property manager, get your act together and start running this like you're supposed to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So
it is frustrating.
It is, but it gives me something to do in my spare time.
So, do you like politics?
I like policy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have no use for politics.
Gotcha.
Because I'm completely anti-partisan. I used to say I was non-partisan. I'm anti-partisan now. When somebody, you know, I can quickly tell when someone is regurgitating the party line on either side.
Sure.
It's like, you know, and think for yourself on this.
Yeah.
Because most people I know have opinions. They're smart. They're informed. But as quick as they decide, first and foremost, I'm of this party or that party, they're kind of giving up their own independence. And,
yeah.
And they're giving up their own, I don't know what you'd call it, their own direction of where mm-hmm. they want to be. So I've been asked to get involved in politics so many times, but my wife has told me if I ever do that, I'll be single.
So no, Randy.
She's pretty big ultimatum.
She's like, you can use the house budget to go hunting, but if you get into politics, that's the line.
Yeah. Nope, it goes away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I use my platforms to do that. And, you know, I appreciate folks like you who probably get some emails about me saying, why do you guys hang out with Newberg, man? That guy, he's a wingnut. I'm very blessed that we have these platforms, that there is an audience out there that the conservation public land message really resonates with, and that we have companies that just say, Randy, keep at it. Just we'll deal with the static. You just keep at it. Yeah. And so I feel really blessed in that situation.
Is there other issues as far as wildlife, you know, public lands, land management that you're tracking that you think people should be aware of?
Yeah.
Topics of...
Yeah. And they're not necessarily related to hunting, but their tentacles reach into hunting. I think, and I don't know how far off in the weeds we want to get on this, but America has really become reliant on free media. If you looked at my bookmarks, I subscribe to so many independent media sources. It cost me $4 a month, $10 a month. But if my knowledge base is dependent upon what I consume and the journalistic integrity of what I consume and the just it being factual and truthful. Okay, tell me the facts. I don't need the BS. If I can't afford $20 a month of subscriptions to do that, then I probably don't want to be that well informed. And I see that a lot of, and again, this is both sides of the equation, where media and entertainment kind of have, you can't tell one from the other anymore half the time. And I just don't trust anything that's free media anymore. I've been led astray too many times. Yeah. I don't want someone to do my thinking for me. And so when I do subscribe to something, I always subscribe in pairs. Because I know even paid media that you subscribe to, they're going to have their slant one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So I want one that's a little bit over on this side on that topic, and I want one a little over on this side that's on that topic. And if they're both saying the same set of facts, I probably can believe it. I don't have to believe their editorial, but I can at least cipher out that, okay, the facts are probably at least correct. And then I'll do my own editorial from that. But I think America's idea that somehow we don't have to value media and where we get it and what we pay for it and what its integrity is, we're probably heading down a...
It's kind of a relatively new phenomenon. At least our ability to be aware of it.
That's the new phenomenon.
That's the new
this
phenomenon.
This has been happening since the beginning
because
of
I'm
time.
Because I'm sure media was always spun. Yeah,
exactly. It's been literally happening since
the beginning.
But you
only knew what you knew. And you only had one or two sources.
The new
sources.
Phenomenon is online.
Yeah.
Right?
Search anything in it.
That's the new phenomenon. Yeah. It's been exposed now where people know that. Like now they know.
Yeah. It's such a different, I feel like at least like with my kids' generation and them being grown up, it's like a cultural shift because when I was a kid, you believed what you heard on the news, or you read the newspaper.
It was a guy in a suit.
It was a guy in a chair, suit and he TV. Sat there.
That guy knows what's up.
Yeah. Like, and that guy says the news everything. And you were just like, that's the news and that's what's going on. And that's
I'm
the
afraid I've maybe gone overboard on it where it's created some strife at times where someone will say, well, did you hear? And I usually don't even hear the next part of the sentence because my first thought is, where did you read it?
Yeah, where'd you hear it?
Well, I read it over on MSNBC or I saw it on Dada. I'm like,
on the Big Hunt Guys podcast.
Right there.
On the Big Hunt Guys podcast.
So I think, and not that I'm going to change the world, but I think challenging ourselves and challenging people who are out there regurgitating the stuff that someone is spoon feeding them. Don't accept that just because someone said something or something shows, right? We all have a news feed on our phone or our computer. There's this thing where you can say, don't show me any more of this. I can't tell you how many of those I don't. Because I know what they are. They're clickbait and they've got zero integrity to what they're doing. And so I've probably created some friction in some relationships by just saying, you know what, if that's the stuff you're going to try
Funny, isn't it, that you've never had more information at your fingertips than you do right now, but it takes that much more effort to now drill down and figure out what's real.
It's a very
the other
thing about
bizarre phenomenon.
Subscribing to stuff on both sides, and I force myself to spend an hour a day every morning reading stuff that a lot of times it's stuff I either didn't know anything about or it's an opinion that I disagree with. But I read it, and I try to read it And I may not agree with it that day, but driving down the road a couple of days later, maybe I'll find a few points in there that are helpful. Mm-hmm. But one thing I've always had pride in the hunting space is we've always tried to be more informed. We try to be very educated about our topics and our issues, and we've kind of stayed in our lane, and we've expected other people to stay in their lane. And that's usually done a lot of good for hunters to have that approach of be informed, stick mm-hmm. with facts, don't let someone spoon feed you this or believe this editorial or whatever. Think your own thoughts about it. And it's served hunting really well for a long time. But we're a cross-section of society. We're no different than the rest of society. So the rest of society is like, yeah, I'm too lazy today. I'm just going to scroll through Facebook and see what pops up. And I'm taking that as fact today. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's good for hunting. As many outside pressures as we're under these days, we need to be more informed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I feel like hunters have pretty well stayed in our lane, but it hasn't gone from the other side. Yeah. They haven't stayed in theirs.
Yeah, I'm about like, ready to go interject out of my ourselves lane. In your lane. When it comes to litigation and all that kind of stuff, I'm all in favor of crossing the ditch, going on over the meridian and over to the other lane. I'm all done with that. That's why I'm so excited that the Elk Foundation announced last month that they've established a 501c4 organization. Because it's about time one of the national groups.
What does that mean for the Elk Foundation? What does it mean for hunters in general?
Yeah, maybe for the listeners. A lot of people don't realize that a 501c3 organization, that's the tax code section that you file an application with the IRS, and if you're approved, donations to your cause are tax deductible. Mm-hmm. But with it comes really tight sideboards about what you can do in the world of politics and lobbying and everything. And so what have we in the hunting space done? We've funded all these nonprofit groups under 501c3 that do habitat work and access work and, hunter education stuff and all kinds of great things. The other side's over there just litigating the crap out of everything and being involved in politics and
making a damn fine living at it, some of them.
Yeah, and so what's the old saying? One team's playing chess, the other team's playing checkers. We've been playing checkers. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we've never had a 501c4 organization on a national level that could just go after it in politics. And here's the distinction between a C3 and a C4. A C4, your donations to that C4 are not tax deductible, but they can go and roll up their sleeves and bloody some noses out in the political arena. They're not going to get restricted. So when I sat on the board of the Elk Foundation, the number of times we would even step over on, even though we had attorneys who consulted, oh yeah, you can do this. Outsiders who don't agree with you, they threaten to turn you over to the IRS to challenge your nonprofit status.
Oh, wow.
So you really got to be careful. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. So the hunting community in this world of litigation and politics, we need more of those 501c3 or C4 organizations, which you guys had, Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management. That's a state-based 501c4 organization. That's why they could jump into Proposition 127 and fight the political game. Mm-hmm. We need that on the national level, and ARMEF has said, you know what, we're done screwing around. We're going to do that. So they're going to have ARMEF is going to be ARMEF. They're helping incubate, and I'm probably speaking out of term here, but they're helping get established. The same, not with their money, but just some of their large donors and some of their experts who know that stuff are like, hey. We've been doing a lot for ARMEF, that's great, but we've decided we're going to come over here and we're going to apply some of that to a new organization. Mm-hmm. So it's not like ARMEF is changing from a C3 to a C4. A bunch of the people involved are just starting one, and once it gets enough funding, there's going to be no shortage of activities for them to be engaged in.
Fight a lot of battles going forward.
Yeah, and I'm... you know what?
Yeah, I love that.
I don't know how much time I have left on this planet, but I'm up for the fight.
Yeah,
I'm just over the you know, the other side saw that we were the head down, stay in your lane, work on conservation, restore species, do all this good work. And they're like, look at those knuckleheads over there. We're going to just sue the hell out of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we'll they're being good guys about it, but I'm done being a good guy when it comes to that anymore. Yeah. Just pack a lunch, pal, because we're going to be here for a while.
But, yeah. So. We had Joel Blakeslee. We talked a little bit about him mm-hmm. earlier. We had him on the podcast. One thing he talked about was lobbying and lobbyist efforts in Washington. And mm-hmm. he said, you know, you'll go down the hallway and, you know, there's 100 lobbyists or whatever it might be for these other, you know, these other organizations. He's like, what we need is we need more people in Washington lobbying on behalf yep. of sportsmen. So it's like almost going from a defensive to an offensive strategy.
Yeah. Yep. I can't remember what he said, if it was a dark blue tag or a light blue tag, but whatever either. One of those is that's what we need.
Yeah. He said, that's what we need.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I never would have thought. I don't really. I mean, I like politics. I follow politics. I always have, you know. But mm-hmm. I never would have thought that, like, when we got into Prop 127, we had Jenny and Joel on talking about wild horses and that whole program and kind of the disaster that it's become. I'm getting much more drawn in and much more interested to me because it's just like, this is something I feel like, you know, I have a voice that I can express and maybe potentially get the word out and make a difference. And there's something intoxicating about that. Mm-hmm. It feels exciting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I watch this podcast or listen to this podcast a lot. And the amount of engagement you guys created in the last year around the Colorado issue, mm-hmm. it's impressive. I mean, you and a few others. I had Dan Gates on my podcast, mm-hmm. and I did a lot of other stuff, but I think anyone who has the blessing of platforms and the trust of audiences in the hunting space needs to realize we got to start allocating some of that time. Content
Absolutely.
To this advocacy
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, you really do. Mm-hmm.
And if we don't, we got to ask ourselves, well, then, well, really, how concerned are we about the future? Because mm-hmm. we can see what the future looks like. It's a lot more litigation and a lot more politics.
Yeah.
And we can say, I don't like politics. Well, you're just going to give up then? Mm-hmm. And I mean, the amount of engagement you guys have created has been impressive.
Appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's been fun, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of fun to get a win, you know, in Colorado. And then...
Yep.
You know, listening to Dan and Hal for Wildlife, listen to those guys talk about taking on more of an offensive approach. Like, hey, let's go fight for a right to hunt and fish. Yeah. So that we
how about how many people showed up to the Arizona big game board?
Yeah, that was awesome. That was
on that Friday morning at 8. I think he said there was over 60 individual people that stood hunting up. Yeah. speakers.
It was funny. I was going to go to that. I was in Arizona at the time. Thursday morning, I'm sick as a dog. I wake up. Marcus is like, you don't look very good. Are you sure you want to hunt today? I'm like, well, let's go try it. 20 minutes later, I'm standing over a really nice coos buck. Mm. And Marcus is like, we got to get you back to the room, man. You're dying.
Yeah.
So I took a bunch of meds and stuff. And that night, as I was hacking and coughing, I'm like, Marcus, what do you say that we go to the Game and Fish Commission tomorrow morning and raise a little hell? And I'm coughing the whole time, and he said something to the effect of, you think they're going to let some tuberculosis patient like you in there? So I slept it off in a hotel room I wouldn't have been sick.
That would have been good to see.
Since my deer tag was filled, I'd have been there. I would only been about a 2-hour drive. And, but that kind of stuff, that's, I think when we all look back in 10 years at what is one of the pivot points in how hunters engage and what we do, Colorado is going to be one of those pivot points.
Mm-hmm.
Because you guys have so well expressed how we need a few wins.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I told Dan. At SHOT Show last year, RMEF invited a bunch of people to come and help build a strategy on this. And I just listened to what their strategy was. And like, man, if we can pull this off, the boost of confidence and enthusiasm it's going to create
mm-hmm.
is worth more than maybe just the victory itself.
I completely agree with that.
And the playbook for future things that are going to be going on, and everyone's fired up about it.
Yeah,
I hope that's been maintained. Yeah. You know, I hope I hope we don't have to keep fighting these battles to get everybody on board to have this. I hope that that energy can be retained and that we can take it to some sort of offensive, like, let's work for our behalf.
Yeah.
Rather constantly. Than constantly defending it, like, what can we do to work on the behalf of wildlife?
Yeah.
Of public, you know, land access and hunting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was, it was good. It was fun. And hopefully we keep the momentum up.
Yeah. I think it was way more productive than arguing about lighted knocks or range finders.
Yeah. That was the other point I was going to say. We could do with a whole lot less infighting.
Yeah.
With, you know, among what camo you wear, with if you wear camo or not.
Trail,
or,
I hate that you hunt with a bow.
Yeah.
And I want to fight you about it.
Yeah. Remember what form I was on the other day. I don't know if it was Hunt Talk or not, but it was, they're all infighting about like technology in the future and range finders and bows and distance of shots and slider sights and turret scopes. And it was a giant thing, like 20-some pages long.
Yeah.
People just arguing back and forth about
it. Yeah, let's take that. Let's take that energy and let's point it this way.
Other way, so we can have more opportunities.
Let's take all that energy and let's point it the opposite way.
We could do something way better with all that time and energy and effort. And
Well, I think the Colorado event, that for those people when they get, you know, neck deep in those kind of arguments, you can say, do you think this would have won in Colorado? You know, everyone arguing about these little things.
Yeah.
Pull your head out here and, you know, spend some of this time doing something productive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Do you, you have a hard out, I think, at 3, and I know Chris Porter said he wants a word with you as well before.
Oh, man.
How about we just
we don't have to keep recording, but, you know, Porter's probably just going to give me the riot act about something or other. I don't know.
We can hide you.
Did he shoot anything this year?
Porter,
what
did I shot a deer.
Oh, yeah.
Shot a nice buck.
Yeah, shot a really nice buck.
That was a good buck he shot.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a dandy heavy buck.
Yeah.
Huh. Big bases, heavy, like dense antler, you know. You ever pick up, we had a guy yesterday here with a bull that brought it in, and it was a 400-inch bull. It was a giant bull,
yeah. But the weight though.
Yeah, that was what was interesting. So I picked that thing up thinking size of antlers, just, you know, score wise, Boone and Crockett, you pick that thing up and you're expecting like, you know, 14 pounds a side plus a skull plate. Pick it up, it wasn't that
way
dense.
More than
it was a lot more porous than I would have thought.
Really?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised.
Wonder where that's from.
I don't know.
It's like your bull a couple years ago, your archery bull. That thing is hefty.
Yeah, that,
you pick it up,
that
heavy.
Utah bull that I killed is probably, I think I had his teeth aged. He's like 7.5 year old bull and he's, you know, busted fifth. But that bull, I mean, if you cut that antler in half, I mean, he would be dense to the core. Just really dense, heavy bull.
Yeah. So, you know, it's been fun as 5 years ago, we started getting every animal we shoot
aged.
That Madsen's is cool.
It's really cool.
I sent you the one on your Wyoming buck, right? Yeah. Seven years
old.
And it's just interesting to see, like, Matthew shot a bull in Arizona this year that is in a unit that they just hunt the bejeebers out of that unit. They're trying to knock numbers down. And somehow he pulls an 8.5-year-old bull out of there.
Yeah.
And it's like,
that bull's seen a lot of shit.
Yeah.
A lot of shit. I'm sure that bull is.
That's
he's seen the light a couple times.
That's truly amazing because a bull elk, like Brady likes to call him, a big yellow school bus on the side of a hill. Side of a hill.
Brady,
the fact that a big yellow school
bus
can avoid hunters is and get to be 8.5 years old is incredible.
Yeah
it is.
Yeah.
That's hide and seek on a whole other level, Brady. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, Brady, you've hunted Montana a lot. Last year, among our crew, we shot on public land, general units, we shot a 7-year-old mule deer and 2 9-year-old mule deer bucks.
Wow.
And that's what's amazing right there, the amount of people that buck has seen.
Not as amazing as the elk, but yeah, it's pretty amazing.
The roads that the deer's had to cross and moving around.
Yeah. But none of them would score over 160 inches.
Yeah, we actually talked about that before, about how people get ridiculed about the size of them, and they always slam you for it. It's like, no, that's actually a really old deer. It's very experienced on getting away from people.
Talk about infighting. You know what I mean? The people are calm. Why would you shoot a baby deer?
What are
you talking about?
Yeah.
Like, what? If you were aging deer off of antlers, like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's added.
Let's point that energy. Let's point that somewhere else.
Somewhere else.
You commenting on somebody's picture. Why'd you shoot a young deer?
Take that angst.
You'd have no clue how old this animal is. And let's just take that and point this this way. let's go talk to these other people. You know, take that energy to these other people.
Yeah, take that angst and send an email to Governor Cox.
Correct.
Just swap it over, or Mike Lee.
The Buckeye shot was a 3x2, 7 years old, but he's stomping around out there. He is running off every buck. There were some nicer 4 points, I'm guessing 4.5, 5.5, and they were scared of him. And I told Michael, I'm like, that's the oldest deer on the hill. I'm going to shoot that thing. And I walked up to that thing. It was body size, one of the most just muscled up.
Love that.
But his antlers were like
tank of a deer.
So, how long is it taking you to get your teeth analysis back these days? Because I have a bunch stacked up, and back in the day it was taking like a long, long time.
Yeah.
I haven't sent them in a while.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm labeled.
To me, I'll drop them off there personally.
I got my label in Ziploc bags.
Of course, Brady does. Like,
that'd be hilarious.
No, I do.
A box of teeth.
I do.
They do them in batches just before I came down here. The two sheep that we shot in the Northwest Territories in August and the mountain caribou, I got those batches the other day.
It was like 6 or 8 months back in the day.
Did the teeth match the horn rings on the sheep?
They did on mine. On Andy's sheep, there was... when they give you the report, they say, like, they grade it an A to, I think, a D or something about the quality of accuracy. And then an asterisk that says some sort of trauma to the tooth. His came back, it said between 8 and 10, and the outfitters counted at least 10 rings. So they'll tell you if they don't think it was a perfect match.
Sample.
Yeah.
What's an old mountain caribou? What's a caribou? How old
are they? I don't know. This one was 8 years old.
Okay.
The one I shot the year before was 9 years old.
Gotcha.
So I think up in that country,
you wouldn't
think
they'd live to be 13 or 14. You'd think 10 would be pushing it, given the environmental conditions of that country and predators. And
I wish more people would send in for
I wish
gauge
they
analysis.
Would. You learn
because that way you
so
learn so much,
much
more, and you're not going to do that infighting thing about these deer. Like, before you post your score in your buck, you know, maybe get your teeth analyzed first, then you can do double on there before you post a photo. That way people get all the big story about what this deer went through. It's actually an older deer.
It causes
deer.
You to think through a few more things, because I think we all jump, I do anyhow, I jump to conclusions of, it must have been a drought here, it must have been this, or it must have been that. Well, sometimes some animals just don't have what it takes.
Yeah.
You know?
Like we talk all the time about.
Whether I was born on a drought year or not, I'm not going to be as tall as Brady. I just don't have it in me. You know, it's just the way genetics are. They're a funny thing.
And I think for me, what I'm more intrigued with it with pronghorn than I am of any of the animals we submit, because some of the biggest pronghorn bucks that I've had aged are three and 4 years old.
Yeah, I saw that.
And that's what the Utah
Pronghorn Guide Service put out a big thing about that. It's crazy.
That was, the Utah did a study on it. Yeah. And they were basically managing these four or 5 year old bucks, and they went back and looked at the trophy potential versus age, and they're like, we're not harvesting a bunch of bucks that we could be harvesting because they're going to reach maturity.
They breed
in 3.5.
At 2 and they're prime at 3, is what Eli said.
Yeah.
It's so wild to think. It's awesome.
Yeah. We shot 2 7-year-old pronghorn in 2022. One in Nevada was a whopper. I can't imagine what he would have been like in his prime. The other was shot in Wyoming, and body size, he looked like a big suey pig, but horn wise he's like a 75-inch buck. He's well past his prime. He might not even have been 75. So it's kind of fascinating to look at two different landscapes, two bucks born the exact same year, and what the difference is
genetics, feed, everything.
That's the bucky count on. So
if you ever get a chance, there's a guy, I had him on my podcast, Dr. Kevin Monteith from Wyoming. Great guy. He's the guy who's been doing all these studies of mule deer and migrations and stuff. And we got in. I didn't realize he is as big of a pronghorn nut as I am.
Yeah.
And we got nerded out on that towards the end when I thought we were going to talk about mule deer. And he said, you know what? I think our data would support a more aggressive hunting of pronghorn bucks because hunters would select for 3 and 4 year olds. And for us to try to grow 7, 8, 9 year old pronghorn bucks, even 5 and 6 year old, they're well past their way downhill by then. But we can shoot more bucks and we're still going to have a decent amount of quality, and we're going to provide more opportunity that doesn't just die due to drought or hard winters.
Yeah.
Like, You got my vote.
No kidding.
Yeah.
The fact that they breed so early, too, and that, I mean, they're obviously past their breed prime early then as well if they're starting at two. So, yeah, why have a 7-year-old buck out on the landscape?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, hunt that buck.
Yeah.
Well, guys, thanks for having me around.
Thanks for coming.
Appreciate you.
I missed promo last podcast. We probably should hit a promo before we end. We're usually supposed to hit it in the first of it, but
first 20, I think is the rule.
First 20, we're gonna hit it in the 98th minute. So if you hung on this long,
we got a surprise for you.
We got a surprise. You can use the promo code podcast. You can sign up for Go Hunt Insider account. We're gonna give you $50 back into the Go Hunt Gear Shop. And Randy, is there any better time to sign up than right now?
No.
Right now is it.
If your people went in the back end and looked at how much time I've spent in this since you updated a bunch of draw odds for states, my wife's back to saying, would you listen to me? I'm like, well, just wait a second, honey. I got to decide which of these three units I'm going to consider when I do my application in May.
Yep. It's go time.
It is. We got 6 states updated. That's a lot more to come. A lot of other cool
I'm
things.
With Randy. That's all I've been doing is looking at odds the last week. I'm just like scheming, planning, hitting people up. What do you think of this idea? Yeah. So
I will say that there are two tags I think we drew last year that we found by all that time that I invest in there we would not have otherwise drawn.
There you go.
Yeah, but I'm not going to tell where they are, and if someone else figures it out, more power to you.
Good idea. Yep. So use the promo code podcast. Last word.
Last word.
And we're out.
Highway, last word.